Knights, greetings and welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 272. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson, recording the show from here at the Central Coast, about an hour north of Sydney in New South Wales, Australia. I'm not out away from noise and cars and traffic and weed eaters and whippersnippers and helicopters and planes as I normally try to be when I record my shows, or as I did a couple of weeks ago. I actually sat in my little room for acoustic isolation. This time I'm sitting out at my little painting table in a beautiful little garden where I'm able to get a lot of work done, and I'm recording this show in honor of trying to share and convey the real Australia as I know and love her so very, very deeply. I wanted to sort of encapsulate my perspective and my involvement and relationship with Australia for the past 19 years since I've been traveling down here, and even longer. Yesterday, I was so lucky to be able to make a trip. I want to thank my beautiful friend Craig Hume. He's a Tibetan Buddhist yeti here in the Central Coast and one of the coolest people you'd ever meet. But he rented a car, four-wheel drive, and drove us up to this very sacred mountain about 2 hours inland west of here called Mount Yango. That's Y-E-N-G-O. A mountain that I've heard about for the past 5 years and have always been trying to make a trip to get there. But from what I've learned and continue to learn, this mountain is as powerful and sacred to the nations of Eastern Australia, the Central Coast and the Hunter region and the Sydney area. This mountain is as sacred and powerful to them as Uluru, what the white man calls Ayers Rock, is to the people of the Central Desert, mainly the Pitjantjatjara and Arunda people. I was first told about Mount Yango from my friend Gavi Duncan, the Gummeroi Darkinjung whale dreaming story person who I interviewed for my show. I think it was in 2014. This was after I had just come back from Tasmania and was really being deeply embraced by the whale dreaming people here on the Central Coast of Australia for the first time. And I've come to learn so much, and my whole big picture and worldview has expanded so much since those years. But Mount Yango, a couple of weeks ago, Alex Herget and I made an initial trip up there on the full moon and the equinox, and we only went as far as the Finchley rock art site, which has engravings of an ancestral being called Baiame, the all-seeing sky father. That's B-A-I-A-M-E. There's another one, another Baiame, at the Bulgandri rock art site here closer to Woi Woi, which is about 10 kilometers from where I am right now. And so we went there, and I did my little ceremony and came back, and I felt very strongly invited to go back a bit closer to Mount Yango. Now, it's such a powerful place, and I always relate with places like this with the utmost respect and erring on the side of caution if I don't have adequate information. So in other words, I would tend to not go places if I didn't feel that it was totally okay, or in the same way that I would never bring any rocks to paint on from a place if I didn't feel good about it or didn't feel like I had spiritual and or official permission from elders and stuff like that, especially in Australia. There's many places I go where I would never bring any rocks anyway, regardless of anything, just because of how I feel. And so with Mount Yango, I felt very drawn to go back. And even though there is a little statement on one of the plaques there that the indigenous people say that Mount Yango, as I think a lot of very powerful sacred, especially mountains, that the only people that were ever allowed to go there were initiates of high order, and even they only went there on very special occasions. And so they even have a sign that says they ask that you, if you're actually at the mountain, that you don't walk more than halfway up it. So what we did yesterday was we drove on a very arduous four-wheel drive road for about 40 kilometers and got to the base of the mountain, you know, just literally right on its base, and stopped. And I sort of tried to feel the energy and spirit of the place. And so we drove around, more than halfway around the base of the mountain before we stopped. And we weren't sure if it was a loop, but we came back and I stopped at this little area I felt drawn to and did a little ceremony. And we did this, we timed it to be right on the new moon, 2 weeks from when I went last time. And oh my God, I cannot tell you how beautiful. I instantly just felt like I was being embraced by all kinds of ancestral beings and spirits who were hugging me and welcoming me and saying how nice it was to see me, and maybe even how nice it was to see me again, even though I've never been there in this lifetime. But I, oh my God, I really felt like I was very, very, very deeply in the dream time. And I was only at this place for like maybe less than 30 minutes, because that's all the time we had, but I played my flute and my drum and burned some sage, and I brought a little painted rock that I left in the earth, and I scooped out a couple of handfuls of the most beautiful soil that you could ever imagine, and just the smell and the texture. It was like caressing the body of Mother Earth. And I left my little painted rock in the earth there and asked if it was all right for me to bring a couple of rocks from there, which I did. I brought one that's going to go on my medicine wheel on Great Barrier Island, and another little piece in my little bag, and a third piece that's kind of a rectangular piece of kind of white quartz. But anyway, all today I've just felt so empowered and caressed by going there yesterday. And it was a very interesting experience, because most of the day was driving. We probably spent about 7 hours driving in the car, but most of it was actually going really slow, like it was probably less than 20 kilometers per hour on this four-wheel driver that was in good condition. But there were spots, there was all these humps that they had made for water drainage and some other places where you had to navigate over rocks and stuff like that. But it was very interesting to ride in a vehicle for that long, but going so slow. And it was just really, it's almost like what it must be like to ride on horseback, except for, you know, I had the noise of the car. I turned off the music. That was another interesting aspect to the day, because the stereo in this vehicle was so good. I was able to play DJ and played a bunch of really cool old music that I haven't got to listen to, and much less listen to on a good system that actually has bass that you can hear. I'm used to sort of only hearing bass on my headphones. And when I came off the mountain, the music I felt like playing the most was some of the instrumental songs by an artist named Enya from Ireland, who I really like some of her stuff. And some of her songs, that seemed to express what I felt having just been there more than anything else. And also some music by a Native American flute duo called Coyote Old Man. That was the first thing I played when we came off the mountain. And a track by David Darling, who was a cellist that had Colin Walcott on tablas and Jan Garbarek on saxophone. So Coyote Old Man, David Darling, and then some Enya was the music that I would play if I wanted to try to help you to recreate that experience. But all today, it's just really crystallized in my mind everything about why I love Australia so much, and what my connections are, and what trying to understand the real people from here and the place herself. And that's a whole story in itself. I'll try to sort of hit the highlights of it on this story. I'll also talk about the vast contradictions plaguing humanity, according to Adlai Stevenson in his original Spaceship Earth quote, but how Australia is the most glaring example of that contradiction in the world, and how, to me, it's the most powerful place spiritually and ecologically on this planet, even though I haven't been that many different places. But there's many reasons for that. but it's also got the most rapid and virulent transformation of a beautiful, relatively undisrupted landscape into just being literally desecrated and decimated and destroyed faster than just about anywhere else on the whole planet. If I look at how I came to be here now, I'll mainly try to just describe things that have happened in this lifetime because I don't have any clear recollection of having existed before, although I do have feelings or intuitions, if you want to call it that, that connect me with certain times and places. But I must share this with you, just to sort of put a perspective on all this. In 2015, I think, I was up in Byron Bay and did an interview with this woman named Stella Wheeldon, and I interviewed her for my show, and she had some very interesting things to share about the indigenous people, the Narqual people, which is a subgroup of the Bundjalungs there in the Willamette Byron Bay area, and her astronomical knowledge and her activism on behalf of the indigenous people and her relationship with Auntie Millie Boyd, who was one of the elders, one of the genuine, real for real elders of that group. And Stella said one day, after she had known for Auntie Millie Boyd for several years, they were talking about something, and Millie Boyd said, "Stella, let me share this with you. My people believe that," and she was referring to a belief that they had been passing down for many, many, many thousands of years, that she said, "My people believe that a long, long, long time ago in Australia, before black people were here, there were people here that looked just like you," that meaning with blonde hair and blue eyes. And Stella said that that blew her away, but that Auntie Millie Boyd was totally serious. And so the implications of that have kind of echoed in my mind. And what if we're talking, I don't know, this would be pre-Atlantean, pre-Lemurian, you know, given that all these mythological sunken continents actually existed. I mean, who knows? What we don't know is probably far freakier than what we think we do know. So there could have been all kinds of previous incarnations of humanity. But that really struck a chord in me because it made me feel like I've got such deep connections to here, and it's almost like the energy of Australia is coming out of me, even regardless of whether I had ever come here or not. Being here has just amplified it and brought it to fruition even more. But to me, it was like when I came to Australia, when I left America in 2000, I didn't think I was leaving, but I didn't know that I was literally, I can say this now, I think that I was really coming home. When I came to Australia in New Zealand, it's like I was actually returning to where I'm really from. Not necessarily in this lifetime, but it feels like a giant cycle that I'm back to not only where I'm originally from on this planet, but to where life originated on the earth. And not that it would have physically originated in just one place, but this ties in with the uniqueness and power of Australia in that geologically it's the oldest crust on the planet, the oldest lithosphere, the oldest rock and sand and stone and soil that we can access. The only older place is Greenland. And not all of Greenland, but parts of it. But the parts that are older are completely under an ice sheet. And I don't know how long they have been for. And I don't think anybody really knows, regardless of what they say. But we're one of the really amazing things about Australia is that, like where we went yesterday, we drove a couple hours from one of the major population centers of Australia. A couple hours, we're way up in the mountains, maybe 700-800 meters in elevation, still east of the Great Dividing Range, but in its foothills, and walking around on land where if we went very far off of the little road, it's possible that we might be walking on land where no European person has ever set foot. And possibly even any indigenous people, because the population density of in their time of maximum inhabitation would still only have been probably a couple of million people or less for the whole continent of Australia. I mean, that's just a very wild guess, but it would have been an ultra, ultra low density. There wouldn't have been anything like even the smallest city or town in Australia now, I don't think. I think it was a very decentralized and mobile form of existence. So in the Australia of today, and especially when you get out up into the territory and into Western Australia, you're very close to land that's had very little, if any, effect and interaction of modern man, which makes it a very pristine, pure energy that you're able to feel and derive information or wisdom from. Anyway, back to this lifetime. When I was 12, one summer evening, I had an experience that really just kind of overnight opened my eyes and my heart to the stars and to the presence of a much vaster universe. And I really fell in love with the stars and astronomy, but it was a mystical kind of a calling or a feeling to explore. I don't know, it's not like I was wondering who's out there, but kind of something like that. But it was like a presence communicating with me somehow. But it was inspiring me to study the stars and to, I don't know, there's no way I can verbalize it, but I became a very avid amateur astronomer and was going to be an astronomer at the time I went to college in 1974. So I started out as a physics major, but after a year or two, I was presented with the work of Dr. John Lilly, who was doing communications work with dolphins in California. And so I fell in love with the dolphins, yeah. And actually went and met a couple within a year, because where I grew up in North Carolina, there was actually more dolphins in captivity there within an hour of where I lived, more dolphins in captivity there than anywhere else in the world at that time. That was very interesting, to be within their psychic noosphere for my whole childhood and youth. And not that they were happy in that place either. So I moved out to California and got involved with Dr. Lilly's group, which was very amazing. But I quickly learned, even though I was there on the day that the dolphins arrived and got to go swimming with them and play them some music, and I wrote an article for the Lilies that was published in the San Francisco Magazine, and that was a great honor, because Tony Lilly told me that of all the articles that they had people to write for them, mine was the only one ever that John didn't have to make any corrections on. So that was really, really quite a compliment. That was only 24 then at the time. So, moved out to California, fell in love with the dolphins, but then I quickly realized that keeping them captive is not cool for any reason. And started really becoming aware of the real threats to their well-being coming from human military industrial civilization. So I started devoting myself to that. And then around 1990, Australia sort of all of a sudden came onto my radar, big time. I think it really began when a friend of mine gave me, well, I can't remember exactly, a friend of mine gave me a book that showed some Aboriginal art from the Central Desert. I remember specifically on the cover of the book there was a painting by this guy named Clifford Possum. And looking through this book, this art, it was like it was alive. It was like it was talking to me. Not in words, but it was just energy was coming through it so beautifully and powerfully, and I felt a very powerful calling to go to Australia. And I almost came in 1990, but I felt I got a message from Spirit up north, telling me to keep doing my campaign of ecological awareness and to try to inspire people to be on the true path of the Great Spirit through all my activism and art and music and photography and stuff, and to do that for another 10 years to fulfill my mission in North America. So I did. I did that in all through the 90s, went all over the USA and Canada at the next level with all my work. And then in 1999, I knew I was supposed to come down under, so I came down to New Zealand, came to Australia, and the very first moment when I set foot on Australia, it was on the evening of July 1st, 2000, and I remember stepping off the boat at Circular Quay, and I remember just being blasted with this giant wave of, it seemed like a giant tidal wave of black death that was hovering over this whole continent. That's what was my very initial impression. I just went, oh my God. It's the kind of thing that you can kind of like, you know, you get like, did I really? I did feel that, but you know, there's got to be more than that. But it was like the aura of the East Coast. But anyway, as the years have gone by, my whole experience in life here has continued to go to the next level, and I've been very deeply involved with understanding the indigenous people, the real people of Australia, and getting to know a lot of them, and the elders of 30 or 40 different nations have my art and bless what I do, and I've tried to do everything in my power on their behalf. And just in the past 2 or 3 years, my understanding of their whole situation has just gone to the next level, and it's incredibly complex. Incredibly complex. And like, but the indigenous people of Australia are so gentle and very telepathic. They're by their very nature, they're just very different from Europeans. They're not accustomed to having to fight tooth and nail to just survive. And they're gentle, like the marsupials. They weren't vicious warriors. They didn't need to be. That they were, in the face of the European onslaught, all of the flora and fauna and people of Australia have been more or less defenseless against the advanced weapon systems and tactics and agendas and the greed and the violence and the selfishness of the European mentality. And every life form on this continent has and is now more than ever suffering immensely at the hand of the so-called white man, who I've actually never seen a white man. Everyone I've seen is sort of like beige, maybe olive, a little brown, peach cream, maybe blue when they're cold, green when they're sick, yellow, red when they're angry. The rainbow people, but I've never seen anybody that was white, not even an albino. And then, as I was saying, around 2014, I began to be really embraced by the whale-dreaming people of the Central Coast, and I learned that, for example, just in Sydney alone, there's over 900 rock art engravings that pertain to whales and dolphins. And I just read that there's over 65,000 recognized Aboriginal sites in New South Wales alone. And several thousand of them would have rock art and stuff like that. And this is just what people know about. And so it's hard to know exactly what it means. It's not like rock art. You could just go and translate it like you'd look at some German and translate it into Italian or something like that. It doesn't work like that. It's a whole different mode of relating with the symbols. And I'm not even sure. You could call it pictographs. I wouldn't call it writing. In the same way that my friend Moira Thames explained to me that as she understood Egyptian hieroglyphs, they weren't writing. They weren't words in the sense of how Indo-European languages use words and symbols, that was probably more akin to music notation. She said that Egyptian hieroglyphics were actually symbols that told of certain sounds to make. So, in other words, it was kind of like a music notation for talking, or some kind of creation of sound. I don't know whether you'd call it talking, or singing, or moaning, or chanting, or whatever. this is where we just don't have any way of comparison. We tend to lump things into categories based on the stuff we have and that we know, but stuff that doesn't fit there just either gets totally neglected or it gets mutated into something that is acceptable and digestible. So I make a pretty good effort to try to get our heads around stuff that we can't really begin to understand without a lot of effort. So my friend Robert Bednarik, the rock art specialist and the epistemologist in Melbourne, he says that the last thing he would ever do, as probably the top rock art researcher in the whole world, the last thing he would ever do is try to translate or determine what any of the rock art means, what it would have meant, because you can't have that meaning if outside the context of being there with the people who made them and know what they are and know how they were to be used and what they were for. And it may be the way that they were approached could be something totally that we can't even conceive. Not like reading, not like playing music or anything like that. And I was talking about my caution in approaching sacred sites. It's very interesting to think about what it is that makes a sacred site sacred. A lot of people go like, oh, well, it's because that's where they had a temple of the ancient people, and it's where they did their sacrifices or had their worship ceremonies, and maybe it's a burial ground or something like that. And this is all because of human stuff that has been done or attributed to the site or the location. And I think there's a lot to that. Places can store energy. You know, the certain kinds of things have happened a lot in the same place, or, you know, in the same kind of way. You can really feel, I've felt this many times in Australia, you're at a place where you feel a great deal of disrupted spiritual energy. You know, it can even be almost overpowering sometimes, a very powerful negative energy that I think is the result of being at a place where a massacre happened, where a lot of people were killed, and there's still a lot of unresolved spiritual energy, unhealed people that were forced to leave their body when they didn't want to, and just all kind of stuff like this. It's in a psychic, maybe this is in the astral dimensions. But a sacred site may, I believe, the biggest part of what makes sacred sites sacred has nothing to do with anything people have done other than be drawn to go there and to develop a relationship with these places. But I think that it has to do with energies of the earth that could be explainable in terms of geomagnetics and telluric currents in the earth and other kind of, you know, physical electromagnetic and forces that certain places might have. I mean, every place has its own unique characteristics and signatures, but places, like, for example, if you're on a lava flow and or atop an ore body of a highly conductive element, like, for example, gold or maybe iron or silver, platinum, I do know that, for example, Nikola Tesla knew that lightning has very powerful, unusual properties in the presence of ore bodies of conductive metals near the surface of the earth. Hence, this is why he built his laboratory in Ames, Colorado, on top of a mountain that was filled with gold, because the lightning had really powerful properties there. And this was back in the day before he had a generator, so it was his only way of capturing a really large burst of electricity to experiment with for a while. So, in that sense, ore bodies, sacred sites, every different mountain, every different cave, every different waterhole and gully and ravine and river has its own unique energy characteristics. I mean, I'm trying to project a physical science coordinate grid over this whole Dreamtime story thing. But, in other words, what I'm saying is that each of these places, what makes it sacred is its own unique, innate and intrinsic energetic and spiritual qualities and powers that it has on its own that has nothing to do with whether people have ever gone there or have ever done anything there. So I think people have figured out or been drawn to, possibly by the intelligence or consciousness of these places themselves, or, as the indigenous people here would say, by the ancestors themselves, who are these landforms. The people have been drawn to come there and create and experience relationships and ceremony and rituals and activities that honor and protect these sacred sites. And now I'm getting to probably the crux of the whole thing, the whole story. I think that the indigenous culture, the indigenous people, a big part of their ceremony, their art, their music, their story, their tradition, their Dreamtime initiation, law, and lore, it has to do with maintaining the true way of life of the Dreamtime in terms of, for example, codes of how you're supposed to live, but also the ceremonies may be related to activities that people are supposed, that part of our true purpose as human beings is to nourish and protect and be the guardians of life. And so at these different sacred sites, each of which may be related to specific energies or specific life forms. Like there may be a dreaming site related to certain kind of trees. There may be a dreaming site related to certain kinds of fish. There may be a dreaming site or landscape related to certain kind of reptiles. A dreaming site related to certain stars and constellations. Dreaming sites related to comets and asteroids. Dreaming sites related to amphibians, insects, butterflies. There may be whale and dolphin dreaming sites, and I'm sure there are. And these dreaming sites are all connected by what has been translated as song lines. And you know, you have to consider the concept of dream time and song lines is sort of an anglicized version of how some of the original people that met the elders and stuff back in the 1700s and 1800s, how they tried to translate what they were trying to explain. So for lack of a better term, I'll use these expressions, dream time and song lines. But I think the song lines are kind of like, they're both physical routes that people would follow, but also every song line has a story and with singing that goes along with it. And so this has to do with how the people would remember. They would simultaneously be able to, they would know their song and they would sing it as they traversed this route. And then as they reached a certain point in their song, they would then be at a certain place where that verse in the song described the mountain that they were passing at that time, because they would have the rhythm and the rate synchronized down. So I think part of they would make these periodic journeys traversing the song lines, and they would be what they call singing up the country, because it was one of our jobs to sing to the land, to let Mother Earth and all the landforms, the rocks and the trees and the wallabies and the goannas and the rosellas and the eagles and to turtles, to let everybody know that we were here and that we love them, and to tell them that we're here. Part of the reason of the song lines. And I think it's also like nerves in your body carrying signals. People would traverse a song line from Byron Bay up to the top of Mount Warning, or from the Wamboril Lagoon here up to Mount Yango, or from Yunbanoon Magnetic Island over to Uluru, a long way there. And so I'm just sort of speculating on some of the functioning of the song lines, but I'm sort of describing the essential indigenous cosmology here, that as I understand it, the ancestors, who are the creator beings from the Dreamtime, and it's not necessarily referred to as being something that happened in the past, it's something that is ongoing now, because the dream time is not the past, it's a different dimension of now. Or it's not really different. I mean, I feel like I pretty much live in the dream time all the time. I think it's a matter of the frequency domain that your mind is tuning into. And I think that the dream time is really almost synonymous with, if not extremely resonant and coherent with, the sort of the noosphere of nature and Mother Earth, of all of life and Mother Earth. Very, very interesting. So the ancestors became the mountains, they became the rivers, they became the gorges and the valleys and the rocks and the trees and the birds and the bees and the wallabies and the goannas. And they are them now. And so Mount Yango, so the story goes, is the place where Bayami, the all-seeing Sky Father, first came down to Earth from the Dreamtime. And as Gabby Duncan told me, he was accompanied by Giong, the whale, the humpback whale. And very interestingly, at the Bayami Rock Art site at Bulgandri, which is the one I've visited quite a few times, there's several clear images of beings that look like whales and dolphins, and a smaller number at Finchley Rock Art site. And so it's very, very interesting. And then he came to Earth and did what it was he came here to do, possibly create. And then he left again to go back to the Dreamtime and took Giong with him. Or now maybe Giong stayed. Maybe Giong is his representative here on the Earth. But see, now that really ties in with John Lilly's vision of the battle going on between water-based life and the solid-state entity based on electronics and computers and silicon. Lilly said that he thought the whales and dolphins of all the life on this planet, they live in the ocean, they're the guardians of the water-based frequency domain, and that they're in touch with water-based life on other planets and other star systems, and that their role is critical for the maintenance of life and the health of life on Mother Earth, because we can't be, it could be that for life to be healthy here, we have to have our connections coming in from these other planets and other star systems, in the same way that a little plant might, it needs sunlight and air and water, and it needs its roots. And so if it gets cut off, it might live for a while, but it won't be healthy, and it won't, may not live too long if it gets cut off. And so it could be that these connections are psychic, etheric, spiritual, as well as possibly gravitational or electromagnetic or other forces that we don't even understand. But Lilly believed that the whales and dolphins know all about this, and that they're involved in maintaining and transducing these signals. And I also believe that the indigenous people of Australia, and not exclusively them, but particularly them, because they are the oldest continuously existing human culture on this planet, probably by orders of magnitude, probably going back 100 or 200,000 years, pretty much living just like that they did up until the 1780s, in a total coherent, balanced, steady state existence where they weren't getting fat, they weren't overpopulating, they weren't getting stupid, they weren't inbreeding, they weren't getting cancer, they weren't destroying their environment. They had a system. Sure, they were people, and not perfect, like everyone. They had their problems, their issues, but they had ways of dealing with it all successfully. They didn't kill each other very rarely. They didn't have institutionalized battles or war or crime, anything like that. It's easy to idealize them. But at the same time, by their fruits you shall know them. And so we know. We saw what they were like in 1788. Until the Europeans came, they had been living as if they were angels in the Garden of Eden for untold millennia. And that's what the power of the William Ricketts sculptures show, the beauty of these people. He sculpted the faces of real people he knew, Arundur and Pitjantjatjara people. They literally, they're so beautiful and filled with love and peace and harmony and little smiles on their face and holding little animals. And truly, truly, what they look like is what I felt in the base of Mount Yango yesterday when I had my feet in the soil and was playing my flute and left my little rock there as a gift. And I think that that is the true spirit of the dream time. And this is what we're modern man, with all our technology and all of our mutated mental operating environments and our agendas of greed and destruction and getting on top of the heap, we're just completely, all these energies and vibrations are still around us. That is the nature of biological and organic reality on the earth, but we're blocking it all out with all the stuff that we're doing, all of our dangerous technologies and all our conveniences and our noise and electronics and chemicals and radiation and vehicles and all the stuff. We don't need all the stuff. The indigenous people of Australia and the whales and dolphins, who I consider to be the indigenous people of the sea and a true extraterrestrial intelligence. The whales and dolphins as the indigenous people of the sea, and the indigenous Australians as the ultimate indigenous people of the land, know how to live in the true way of the Great Spirit. They don't need very much, if anything, in the material world outside of their own bodies. The whales and dolphins don't even have hands. They don't even have any material possessions at all. They don't have mirrors. They don't have toothbrushes. They don't have shoes. They don't even have hair. The indigenous people of Australia didn't use metal, but they did use tools. They built structures to live in sometimes, but they were just, they were able to live in a way that you didn't need or want all the stuff that we feel like we have to have. And most people would have to have all this stuff, or else they would just shrivel up and blow away in the wind like some dust, like a mummy that collapsed on itself. But I mean, to me, it would be so cool if you could just curl up like in a cave or on a bed of grass and sleep at night and be totally warm and comfortable, or always have, like, say, like if it was raining, you had a little place to go, but, or in the daytime when it's nice and you can just sit out on the grass by the water and play your flute or carve some rock art or something like that, or go and chase your girlfriend. To be able to, and see, this is why a big part of what's been happening with me in recent years is the indigenification of myself. I'm becoming more and more indigenous as the days go by. For example, I mean, this is, it's a spiritual transformation, but it's also manifest in things like that. I don't mind being where it's quite chilly. I don't mind swimming in water that's cold. I swam in water that was only 11 degrees in Adelaide last year for several weeks. Now it's a balmy 24, which feels like it's not quite as warm as a bath, but I love going in the ocean. But I don't like to have a lot of clothes on. I don't like to walk around naked, although I do sometimes in the sunshine if there's nobody around. But I don't like to be encumbered. I like my body to be able to get sun and to be able to breathe. And I really don't like wearing shoes. I'll wear my open-toed shoes whenever I need to go out, if I'm on the bike. If I'm driving, I'll usually drive barefooted and put my shoes on when I get out. But I like to just be barefooted almost all the time, and it just feels so good to walk on sand and to walk on grass. And my partner and I of 5 years, Elizabeth Verstraten, and I both kind of evolved into this way of being where we were just really blessed by the ancestors and our guardian angels, and they arranged for us to be able to spend quite significant periods of time, both in New Zealand and mainly in Australia, in quite remote places where we were totally away from, like on Flinders Island, Tasmania. We were able to live for over 4 months at our friend Arnie's remote property, not just off the grid, but with no electricity at all. There's no electricity coming in there, and no solar panels except for one itsy-bitsy tiny little thing that might supply enough power for our transistor radio. It's the only electricity there was, other than what we had charged in our camera batteries. So we'd go to town once every week or two and buy some groceries and charge our batteries and go online. We had a landline phone. But other than that, we were like many kilometers away from any electricity, any source of radio or microwaves or anything like that. Of course, there was the big level stuff coming down from the sky. At that point, I did not yet own a microwave meter, but it wouldn't have shown anything. We did see chemtrails being sprayed right over us quite regularly. They're not a lot, but occasionally. But this is an island that's halfway between Tasmania and Melbourne. So what happened, we noticed that during this long period of time of being totally away from almost every form of anthropogenic influence, very quiet, we noticed after the weeks went by, we became much more sensitized to feeling and hearing and smelling and tasting and touching. The voice of nature, the voices of the birds, the sound of the wind and the casuarina trees and the sound of the ocean, it's like you can hear the little voices of these fellow beings communicating with us and feel their feelings. And we became very, very sensitized. And then when we went back into Australia and then we went to New Zealand, we were able to, because of our increased sensitivity and also the way that we had educated ourselves about the whole scenario of geophysical warfare using chemtrails and the electromagnetically enhanced microwave transmissions in the stratosphere that can be involved in inducing earthquakes, manipulating cyclones, anomalous bushfires, and that kind of thing. All the stuff that people think is being caused by a few parts per million of carbon dioxide called climate change. People think that's doing that, and it's just not physically possible. Anyway, we became so sensitized that one day in Christchurch, we looked at ourselves because we walked out of the backpacker and saw all these freshly sprayed chemtrails, and we felt this really beefed up microwave vibe in the atmosphere, which Lisbeth felt it even more than me. And we looked at each other and we said, look, I bet there's going to be an earthquake today. This was 10 o'clock in the morning. This was December 23rd, 2011 in Christchurch. 10 o'clock in the morning, we said that. At about 1:15 that afternoon, there was a 5.6 quake followed by another 5.4 about 45 minutes later. And so we successfully predicted an earthquake based on our ability to feel what our bodies were picking up on in the local environment. So I think that indigenous people, especially of Australia, people in our true natural environment, living on the true path of the Great Spirit, our minds are free of all the clutter and the agendas. And disease is really the only way to describe the basic mentality of modern man. People are just so wrapped up and completely irrelevant. Even the happiest people I know are still more or less obsessed with completely irrelevant bullshit. And then, but those are few and far between. Most people are just wrapped up in all kinds of superfluous dramas relating to things that I've tried my hardest to not ever have in my life, or if I did, to get rid of it. Just to be free to do the work I'm here to do, to be creative and to be able to honor what it means to be truly human and to be of service to my fellow man and to be a kaitiaki for all of life and to be able to understand what the whales and dolphins are trying to tell us and to be a clear receptacle and vehicle and a sacred temple for truly the Holy Spirit of the Great Spirit, which is what we are. Every living thing has a drop of the divine consciousness that's the miracle of life. That's what I think, and this has nothing to do with any religion. It's not even a spiritual system. It's just kind of like telling it like it is. So I think that the indigenous people of Australia, this is their true nature. And in the world of today, even though there's still probably at least 70,000 full-blooded Australian Aboriginal people, probably very few, if any, of even them, even though they're 100% genetically Indigenous Australian, they're still not really going to be Indigenous people, in the true sense, because the only true indigenous people anywhere could only be ones that have not yet been contacted or discovered by Europeans. Because once even that initial contact is made, if they're aware of us, even if no communication happened and no physical contact, even if they like saw us, for example, it would change how they think. We would be a presence in their mind to be reckoned with, and probably with good reason feared. So I'm just saying, this is the most minimal. So the only true indigenous people left would be those who don't know that the outside world exists. I mean, the outside world being that of civilization. Not to mention that they would still, even if they don't consciously know about civilization, they would still be influenced by the global magnetic flux that is generated by the electrical grid and the microwave transmissions and the chemicals and the radionuclides in the air and stuff. And they would be affected by all this. And possibly, if it's possible that there are some indigenous people living somewhere that don't know that civilization exists, they might be detecting and wondering about these forces or effects or energies or things that they can tell that are not healthful, that are suddenly becoming present in their mental and spiritual and physical environment, you know, especially since World War II. And so, but it's kind of tautological to say that if we don't know about these people, we don't know about them, and vice versa. And I hope, in some ways, I really hope that some people like that do exist. And I hope that we never discover them. I hope that they never end up on a David Attenborough BBC show. I hope they never have a documentary film made about them. I hope they never learn English or have trendy yuppies going there to take their drugs or to learn how to make baskets in the way that they do it. I hope that nothing like this ever happens. And when you look at the whales and dolphins as being the ultimate indigenous people, at least they're free from that kind of thing, because they live in the ocean. They don't have hands, they don't have clothes. No one's ever going to go and take people dancing at the whale and dolphin discotheque. That's what happened with the little guy that was in that movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy. I feel like my biggest mission in this life, and why I've been brought to Australia and continue to be shown such beautiful, magnanimous blessings and gifts from Australia, the land and her people, is to try to carry the torch of the Aranda and Pitjantjatjara elders, who I feel are who called me down under in 1990. I think they were putting out a signal for people to come here who might be able to hear their message and capable of carrying the torch of this connection with water-based life through their art. And I really feel like that's what my art, my painting, is all about. It's not about pretty pictures. It's not just about whales and dolphins or astronomical stuff. It's about conveying the Dreamtime story. I've been told by Barbara Randall, who was the widow of Uncle Bob Randall, the elder, the custodian of Uluru, that I'm painting the new dreaming. And I really think that there may be a lot of truth in that. And it's so interesting that my feeling that I'm actually from here a long, long, long time ago, and that I've come back to where I'm from at this particular time to try to bring in the new dreaming, but also to be aware, to have received messages and warnings and information from the indigenous people of the land and the indigenous people of the sea, telling us that not only is the new dreaming coming, but the old dreaming that's been distorted and corrupted and desecrated and treaded on by the European people, and now almost everybody's a part of it, it's beyond the point of no return. We can't possibly correct this ourselves, even if we wanted to, and we aren't showing any signs of using less hydrocarbons or mining or driving less or anything we've got the pedal to the metal, and it's going to be, it's clear that the Hopi prophecy is going to be fulfilled, possibly a lot sooner than we think. And I think that civilization on this planet is going to be taken out by a global catastrophic sequence of events triggered by impact from a comet or an asteroid fragment. This is a hypothesis I've really been developing a lot over the past few years, but I think that this is what has to happen. It's the only way Mother Earth can get rid of the disease that's infesting her. And it's, you know, I've tried to map the Koyaanisqatsi of the military-industrial civilization in many of my shows and with a lot of my work, and it's so huge. Just trying to map the global nuclear scenario, or the electromagnetic microwave scenario, or the chemical toxicity scenario, or the whole thing with genetically engineered organisms, the whole thing with the psychology of mass communication. Each of these is a whole world of destructiveness in itself, but taken all together, this is the summation of the legacy of man the wise, Homo sapiens. And so I really love the film The Last Wave, Peter Weir, 1976. It was the sequel to Picnic at Hanging Rock, but it's based on an ancient Aboriginal prophecy that the east coast of Australia would one day be destroyed by a giant tidal wave. And this is just eastern Australia. But Stella said that Auntie Millie Boyd refused to live near sea level for that very reason. This is turning out to be one of the most fantastic visits I've had to Australia. I visited Mount Yango twice on the equinox and the full moon, and then much closer on the new moon. And I know a lot of amazing, wonderful encounters and adventures await me on this visit. And I'm trying to go ever more deeply into the dream time to understand the knowledge and message and warning and wisdom and story of the whales and dolphins and the First Nations Australians and all of water-based life, and to express this in everything that I do, and to try to inspire all of us, because we're not going to prevent the day of purification happening. But through all of our good work, every way that we can lessen our impact and increase our love and decrease our destructiveness on our fellow life forms, through the summation of all of this, we can hope to lessen the severity of the purification, which means sparing a lot of innocent life forms of non-human beings who are already suffering because of what our species is doing. I better go for now, and I've got some artwork to work on. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson, Into the Dreamtime, Ancestors, Songlines, and the Real Australia. Please remember to live simply so that others may simply live.
Good day.